Well, thank you for coming. I hope you had a good sleep in today, an extra hour. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're making a new turn in our investigation of the Bible, because yesterday, those three talks... I gave three talks, didn't I? Three talks were about how the Bible satisfies the deepest longings of the human soul. And so you might call that apologetics of the existential kind, apologetics of a cultural kind. But what I want to also do today is a little more academic or intellectual. I want to investigate the history. So not just the way the Bible satisfies our deepest human needs, but the way the Bible is credible historically. And in particular, I'm going to focus on Jesus. He is the punchline, the climax of our biblical story. And the resurrection. Now, it's very difficult to do Jesus and the resurrection in 1 hour. I teach a course at Sydney University on the life of Jesus. It's a secular state university. It's a history course on the life of Jesus. And we spend 26 hours on the life of Jesus. So us doing this in 1 hour is going to be difficult, but we'll give it a good go. I always say, whether to students or public groups, that the figure of Jesus should be of interest to people, whether they are believers or skeptics, because of his immense influence on Western culture, at least. So even if people don't believe in the religious dimension of Jesus, it's wise for our skeptical friends to know something about Jesus, simply given his influence. And interestingly, his influence was recently tested. In a 2013 Cambridge University Press volume, two information scientists, both non-Christians, tested the relative impact of 1,000 historical figures, from the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, through to the scientist Albert Einstein, and they created a mathematical algorithm to test the impact of these various historical figures to see who had had the most impact. And it won't surprise anyone in this room that they discovered Jesus, according to their own mathematical model, was the most influential figure in the history of the world. Both these information scientists were a bit embarrassed about their own finding and in public interviews consistently said, "We're not Christians. We're not interested in Christianity. That's just what the maths told us." So even our most skeptical friends should know something about the historical Jesus. And it's difficult for them to know reliable information about Jesus because there is so much skepticism and doubt about the figure of Jesus. The National Geographic Channel in America published a documentary a few years ago claiming they had found a Gospel of Judas. You've heard of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They were claiming that there was another Gospel written by Judas, the betrayer of Jesus. And they gave the impression that this was an authentic gospel. But if you listened closely, it was quite clear that this was not a gospel written by Judas at all. It was a 4th century copy of a 2nd century forgery in the name of Judas. No historian thinks there is a Gospel of Judas. But if you spend enough money on a documentary, you can make anything sound plausible. The Discovery Channel also produced a documentary claiming that they had found the tomb of Jesus. And there was a burial box of Jesus in this tomb. And the burial box had the name Jesus written on it. And this Jesus was still in the tomb, which is not meant to have happened, right? And the whole documentary left the impression that this really might be the tomb of Jesus, and this Jesus is still in the burial box. What they didn't reveal is that the word Jesus was the sixth most popular boy's name in Judea and Galilee in the time. There were thousands of Jesuses, and the chance of this Jesus being the Jesus is almost non-existent. The tomb was nowhere near where the Gospels say Jesus' tomb was. It was a completely different kind of tomb. And there were about 20 other people in the tomb. There is no way it was the tomb of Jesus. The new atheists also claim that we might not know anything about Jesus. Richard Dawkins says a serious, if not widely held, historical case can be made that Jesus never lived at all, as has been made by Professor G.A. Wells of London University. These atheists suggest we don't even know if Jesus lived. There is a lot of skepticism toward Jesus, and it contrasts strongly with what Luke tells us at the very front of the gospel, that this material is solid. He writes, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." Luke clearly thinks he's writing historical fact. "Eyewitnesses saw this," he says. "I've investigated everything," he says. "And you may know the certainty of these things." In the original Greek of Luke, the word certainty is the Greek term asphaleia. In English, I don't know about Swedish, we get the word asphalt from it. The stuff you make roads out of. Is asphalt a word in Swedish too? It is. That's clever. It comes from this Greek word, the certainty, the asphaleia. It means solid. It means something you could build on. Luke says this material is solid, asphaleia. It is as solid as an ancient coin. This is a Roman denarius from the time of Jesus. That's Emperor Tiberius on the front. His mother Livia is on the back. And this particular Tiberius, denarius, is the one I'm wearing around my neck right now. And I'm going to take it off, if I can undo the clasp, and pass it around to you. This is a genuine 2,000-year-old Roman coin. I've collected coins for many years. And I wear this, of course, partly because when the Lord was asked, should we pay taxes to Caesar, he held up a Tiberian denarius and said, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's." Yeah? And I'm not saying it is this very coin, but it is this coinage, this same coin from the ancient world. A jeweler has put it in a nice case. The coin is uninterrupted. But I want to pass it around. Maybe everyone can have a play with it. My point is this. The history of Jesus is as solid as that coin in your fingers. As you feel that solid silver, it's a reminder that you are being transported back 2,000 years. 2,000 years ago, other people on this same planet were holding that coin and buying things with it. And some poor guy lost it to be found nearly 2,000 years later. And now it's in your hands. My point is, the history of Jesus is asphaleia, solid. Okay, so it's in this context I want to try in our 1 hour to get through seven things we should know about Jesus and the resurrection. It'll be interesting to see if I can get through all of these, but these are six general things about history and then one specific test case, the resurrection of Jesus. And my promise to you is that I'm going to share with you information that I could teach in a secular university, not just in the safe environment of a Christian conference. This is precisely the sorts of things secular historians will agree on. So here they are, seven things. Ready? I'll keep speaking slowly. Secular scholarship has no substantial doubts about the general course of Jesus' life. Secular scholars don't agree with everything in the Gospels, the way you and I do, but they do agree. We know an awful lot about Jesus. There are no substantial doubts about the general course of his life. Here is Ed Sanders of Duke University in the US. He is largely a skeptic. He isn't sure Jesus rose again. He disagrees with lots of things in the Gospels. He is not an evangelical or an apologist. He's a historian. But he writes, "There are no substantial doubts about the general course of Jesus' life. When and where he lived, approximately when and where he died, and the sort of thing that he did during his public activity." This is a good representative of secular scholarship. We know an awful lot about Jesus. And there is a shortcut to demonstrate this to our secular friends. Because if Finland is anything like Australia, an increasing number of people think maybe Jesus was just a myth, not even a real historical figure. That maybe he's like one of the, you know, Nordic gods of old, just a myth. But there is an easy way to show to our secular friends that historians think he was a real figure. You can turn to the major secular compendiums of ancient historical knowledge and see what they say. This is the Oxford Classical Dictionary, 1,700 pages, summarizing what ancient historians know about Greece and Rome. This is an encyclopedia that ancient historians themselves use. We all have this on our bookshelf as the best one-volume summary of all things ancient Greek and Roman. There is a section on the birth of Christianity. There are several paragraphs on what historians may know about the real Jesus. And there is no doubt whatsoever raised about the general course of Jesus' life. And what we can say to our skeptical friends is, why does a secular summary of historical scholarship not even raise a doubt about Jesus' existence? The other example is the 22-volume summary of historical knowledge known as Brill's New Pauli. It is mainly German scholarship, recently translated into English, and you can get yourself a copy for a mere 5,700 euro. It is, as it says, an encyclopedia of the ancient world. It is entirely secular. But there is a 5,000-word essay on what historians know about Jesus. And it raises no doubts whatsoever that he was a real person who taught, who had a reputation for healing, who was executed under Pontius Pilate, whose disciples thought they saw him, though this article doesn't say they did. And my point is, how could a secular summary of ancient historical knowledge not raise any doubts about Jesus' existence? The answer is because there is no doubt about his existence. I was so confident of this some years ago. When was this? 2014. I wrote an article for our national broadcaster, the ABC, where I set out a challenge. If you can find one professor of ancient history or classics or New Testament in any university in the world who argues Jesus didn't even live, I will eat a page of my Bible. The article got a lot of attention, and people started to quote professors at me. But they were professors of English literature, professors of poetry, professors of psychology, professors of philosophy. Not one professor of ancient history or classics or New Testament in any university in the world. My Bible is safe, friends. No fear, no fear. Secondly, the story of Jesus is broadly corroborated by ancient non-Christian authors. Part of the reason secular scholars don't doubt there really was a Jesus is because we have non-Christian writings from within the century of Jesus that refer to Jesus. There are 11 non-Christian references to Jesus from different writers. 11. And at Sydney University, we spend 3 hours on these 11. You can rest assured we're not going to do that. We're just going to quote two of them in just a few minutes. Two of the most significant non-Christian references to Jesus are these. One, Tacitus. Tacitus is the greatest of ancient Rome sources. Tacitus is the main body of knowledge for emperors from the ancient world. If you know anything about Emperor Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and so on, it's from Tacitus, the great chronicler, historian of the ancient world. And he mentions Jesus. And here is his mention of Jesus on the screen. Christians derived their name from a man called Christ, who during the reign of Emperor Tiberius had been executed by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. The deadly superstition, thus checked for the moment, broke out afresh not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but also in the city of Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world meet and become popular. He is not a fan of Jesus, but he mentions Jesus in the right time, in the right place, executed under the right conditions. The other reference that I'll mention from the non-Christian writings is the first century Jewish writer Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish army general who was in charge of Galilee, Jesus' home district. And Josephus, toward the end of the first century, mentions Jesus in these words. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing, amongst us had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. And the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. On the internet, there's lots of discussion about Josephus, and some skeptics think that Christians invented this paragraph and stuck it in the books of Josephus. Actually, what I've just read you is what secular historians agree Josephus really wrote. From this, from the non-Christian writings about Jesus, we know an awful lot about Jesus even without opening a Bible. We would know when and where he lived. We would know that he was a famed teacher. We would know that he gathered disciples. We would know that he did baffling deeds, what Josephus says are surprising feats. We would know that he was crucified, of course, and we would know that his disciples declared him the glorious Messiah. So how is it that Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist, can suggest in his book that a serious historical case can be made that Jesus never lived at all? How can a very, very bright professor at Oxford say Jesus may never have lived and then offer one professor, G.A. Wells? G.A. Wells is professor of German language at London University. He's not a historian. He doesn't have any historical training, no ancient language training. He's a professor of German language who wrote a popular book 30 years ago saying he didn't think Jesus lived. But what relevance does that have? Can you imagine if I made a controversial scientific claim and cited a German professor, a professor of German language, as my authority? I'm sure Richard Dawkins would say, you can't do that. He's not an expert. And I would say, you're absolutely right. And nor is G.A. Wells an expert. Actually, G.A. Wells changed his mind, by the way. The year after Richard Dawkins' book came out, G.A. Wells wrote another book saying he was probably wrong in the first book to say Jesus never lived. But that's another fun story. I have said that secular scholars don't doubt the general course of Jesus' life. I have said that the story of Jesus is broadly corroborated by non-Christian authors from the ancient world. But these non-Christian references are not the main historical sources. Even secular scholars agree that the main sources for our knowledge of Jesus are in the New Testament. Secular historians do not treat the New Testament as the Word of God. They don't read it in the mornings and ask the Lord to speak to them, of course. But they do treat it as a human text from the first century. And when they analyze the New Testament as a human text from the first century, they can learn lots of things about Jesus. And I want to explain now in these next few points why secular historians, not theologians, secular historians, take the New Testament pretty seriously. I don't mean they revere it. I don't mean they obey it. But they take it seriously as a historical source from the first century. Okay, so here is my third point. The New Testament is a rare example of historical records of the powerless. We have very few sources from the ancient world from below, from the people below, from the poor and the weak in the Roman world. We have a few shopping dockets. We have a few single letters between husband and wife. But we don't have substantial writings from the lower classes. Almost all of our ancient writings are from elites. The powerful, senators, academics. All the sources you may have heard of, Pliny, Tacitus, Plutarch, Josephus, they are all elites, the upper classes. Now, there is a reasonable fear and suspicion reading elite sources. The modern historian today worries that we are missing the voice of the ordinary person from the ancient world. All we're getting is the elites. And secondly, we sometimes fear that what we're reading is almost a justification of power, a manipulation, because the powerful get to tell the history. Okay. People sometimes say this is also true of the New Testament. People sometimes say the New Testament was a document of political creation by Emperor Constantine in the 4th century. Constantine wanted to control the Roman world, so he created a New Testament to control people with a new religion. If that sounds a little bit like that old book, Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, it's because it's exactly what Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code says. But many people think it. But here's the crucial thing. The New Testament is a rare example of literature from the lower classes. And a modern secular historian is really impressed by this. I interviewed for my podcast this woman, Teresa Morgan, who is one of the world authorities on ancient Greek and Roman literature. She is a professor at Oxford University. And I interviewed her for my podcast about lots of different things. But one of the things that she said that was very striking is that as a historian, she loves the New Testament because it is the voice of the lower classes, the voice of the non-powerful. And we can tell that the language of the New Testament is non-elite. It's the everyday Greek, not elite Greek. The key figures mentioned in the New Testament are generally lower class people. Even Paul, who had some status and was educated, lost his status when he became a Christian. So even Paul's letters are written by someone with no power. And we can tell that the first 3 centuries of copying the New Testament in manuscripts was done by non-professional scribes. We can tell because the handwriting is not the beautiful handwriting you get in the 5th century. In the 5th century, our New Testament texts are gorgeous. The lettering is perfect. And it's because by the 5th century, the church does have power and they can afford the best scribes in the land. But all of our manuscripts from the 2nd century, 3rd and 4th centuries are written by non-elite scribes. All of this is to say that the New Testament is not one of those texts historians are suspicious of as a manipulative power text. They regard it as a precious text from the powerless, giving us insight into ordinary people from the ancient world. There's another reason the New Testament commends itself to secular historians, and it is that the New Testament is the best attested text of classical antiquity. What do I mean? I mean, very simply, we can be more confident reading a New Testament today and knowing that it was what was written originally in the first century, then we can be confident about any other writing from the ancient world. Again, this is not something I will only say here in the safe environment of a Christian conference. This is something I could say in any classics or ancient history department in the world, and every historian would agree. we have a very high degree of confidence that the New Testament you hold in your hands today is what was written. How do we know this? Because we have so many manuscript copies. And when you have more copies, you can be more confident of what was originally written. See, if you only have two handwritten copies of a letter, and one of them is different in one paragraph, how do you know which is the original? If you've just got two copies, and one of them is slightly different, how can you tell? But what if you have 3, 4, 5, 6, 20 copies of the letter, and that variation is clearly the minority? You can tell that that's where a mistake was made, but all the others don't have that mistake. Now, this is very important because the New Testament is copied out in more copies than any other writing from the ancient world. I mentioned Tacitus. Tacitus, the greatest of ancient Rome's writers, but we only have two large partial manuscripts of Tacitus. Two. They are both held in a library in Florence, and based on just two, we have a degree of confidence that what we read in Tacitus is what was written. Virgil's Aeneid was the most popular Latin text in the first century, and it is the best attested Latin text. We have three complete ancient copies. We have seven partial copies. Let me say, partial copy doesn't just mean a page or two. A partial copy could be 100 pages. That would be a partial copy. And we have 20 papyrus fragments, that is 20 single pages. But from three complete manuscripts and seven partial manuscripts and 20 papyrus fragments, we can work out what changes have been made, what accidents have been made in the copying, and we can correct them. So that when you read Virgil's Aeneid today, you can be very confident you are reading what Virgil wrote. How does that compare with the New Testament? We have four complete, or very nearly complete, manuscripts. So you can see that instantly compares pretty well with the best Latin text we have. But where it gets really interesting is in the number of partial manuscripts we have. We have 340 partial manuscripts. And let me remind you, a partial manuscript could be 80 pages of Paul's letters. That would just be counted as one. 80 pages. I got to play with one of these partial manuscripts recently. It's stored in a vault, in a vault, in a vault in the University of Michigan. That's where a whole bunch of pages of Paul's letters are stored. I recorded a podcast there. That's me holding a copy of Romans. That was really fun. But a partial manuscript could be three of the Gospels. We have 340 of them. And when we refer to papyrus fragments, that is single pages, we have literally thousands. So can you see how the historian's task is much easier with the New Testament than with any other text? Because we can line up on a table, or nowadays on a computer, the four complete New Testaments from the ancient times, the 340 partial New Testaments, and the thousands of single pages, all copied in different places at different times, and we can pull them all together and go line by line by line to see where the variations have taken place. And we can therefore tell what is a variation and what is original. And as a result of this, you can be more confident of what is in the New Testament today than you can for any other text of the ancient world. Fifthly, the New Testament provides early evidence for the events it recounts. The New Testament evidence is early. You sometimes hear people say that the New Testament was written 100, 200 years after Jesus, and therefore can't be trusted. But actually, let me show you the dates of the New Testament writings that are accepted by secular scholars, but compared to other ancient writings that scholars use. For example, Alexander the Great. I'm sure you've heard of Alexander the Great. Our first biographical source for Alexander is Polybius, who wrote 120 years after Alexander was dead. Our other main source is Arrian, and that is from 400 years after Alexander was dead. What about Tiberius? Secondly, Emperor Tiberius ruled the Roman world when Jesus lived. Tiberius is the one whose face is on my coin, which is still safely somewhere. Yes. Our very best biographical account of Tiberius's life is Tacitus, whom I've mentioned already, and he wrote nearly 80 years after Tacitus. This is regarded as pretty good, actually, because ancient historians worry if something is way too early, it won't have the perspective needed. But if it's too late, the chances of something changing are very real. But something in between is good. Let me compare this with the New Testament. All New Testament documents were written within 65 years of Jesus. And some of our New Testament documents are from within 20 years of Jesus. Secular scholars think the last New Testament writing was John's Gospel. Most secular scholars put John's Gospel around the year 90, something like that. That's 60 years after Jesus. And that's the latest of all the New Testament texts. But some of our New Testament texts are as close as 20 years. When people are still, many people are still alive who knew the events themselves. What this means is that the latest text of the New Testament is still closer in time to Jesus than the best source for the emperor at the same time. The best source for Emperor Tiberius is Tacitus, written 80 years later. But the latest source of the New Testament was only written 60 years after Jesus. And we still have texts within 20. So there, if you prefer it visually, that's just a nice simple summary for you, right? Alexander dies. You got to wait 120 years before you get Polybius giving an account of his life. Tiberius dies. You've got to wait nearly 80 years before you have Tacitus. Jesus dies. It's just 20 years. A period when many people are still alive who knew the events. Now, this doesn't mean historians believe every word of the New Testament the way you and I do as Christians. But it's one of the reasons they take the New Testament pretty seriously, because it's closer in time to the events than many of the ancient writings we deal with. I have a sixth point. The New Testament provides multiple sources, not just one. This is sometimes hard for Christian believers to understand because the New Testament is in one volume today, right? You can hold it in one volume and it looks like it's just one book. But of course, a moment's thought tells you that the New Testament is made up of many books by many different writers. And those different writers didn't have each other's writings in front of them. So Paul, for example, didn't have a copy of Mark's gospel when he wrote his letters and mentions Jesus. And Mark didn't have a copy of Paul's letters when he wrote his gospel. So Paul couldn't consult Mark, and Mark couldn't consult Paul. And Paul, being our earliest sources, gives us loads of information about the history of Jesus. I'll just put that up on the screen. We don't have to go through it all. But just to say, even if we had no other New Testament writing, no gospel at all, we would learn just from Paul's writings an awful lot of information about the actual historical Jesus. I just throw that up there for those who might be interested. But the real interesting point is, we don't just have Paul. We have Mark. We have John. We have James. And in fact, there are sources within the Gospels. So Luke, for example, actually uses earlier sources. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, because here's what Luke says at the beginning of his gospel. I read it out earlier. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. His opening line tells us he knows of many other writings about Jesus. But he's writing in the 70s. So by the 70s, he knows many other writings. And he says he's investigated these and has now written his account. He has told us in the opening paragraph that he uses other sources in his gospel. Now, the importance of that is that secular scholars identify these independent sources, that is, sources in the New Testament that are not copied from one another. Now, I know that looks like a very complicated diagram, and at university, we spend an hour just on the details of this diagram. So I apologize that I'm just going to give it to you in, you know, a few minutes. The Gospel of Mark is one source. Okay, that sounds pretty safe. You've all read the Gospel of Mark. Paul's letters, that sounds like one source. You've read those, okay? James, you've read that one too. Now, the interesting thing is those three sources aren't copied from one another. But we can do better than that. Within Luke's gospel, there is a source called Q. It's in Luke and Matthew. And in Matthew, there's a source called M. And within John's gospel, there's one called SQ. And within Luke's gospel, there's another one called L. Luke's gospel uses three sources: Mark, L, and Q. Now, these are the secular conclusions. You don't have to believe any of it. But here's the interesting thing. It actually amplifies the credibility of the New Testament. It raises the credibility of the New Testament because scholars are looking for how many different sources, not copied from one another, say the same thing about Jesus. And if you only have one source, you don't know whether to believe it. If you have a second source and you know that isn't copied from that, and it says roughly the same thing, you think, oh, that could be true. It's like if you hear some bizarre news, some strange news from one friend. You may or may not believe it. It depends how trustworthy your friend is, I guess. But what if you hear the same news from a second person, and you know that second person didn't get it from the first? And then you hear the same news on the radio, and you're sure the radio didn't get it from the first source or the second. You're very likely to think it's credible, yes? This is common sense, but historians have a name for that common sense. They call it the criterion of multiple attestation. This is one of those things you can forget as soon as you hear it, but it means that when numerous sources independently offer roughly the same portrait of an event or person, that portrait takes on greater plausibility. So, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Secular scholars agree that there are between five and seven independent sources now in the New Testament that were not copied from one another. And this becomes incredibly significant for historical analysis. Because if we find the same thing mentioned by Mark and Paul and Q, three sources, historians think there's a very good chance that's a real thing going right back to the beginning. That's the criterion of multiple attestation. All right. There are six general historical things worth knowing about how secular historians study Jesus. These are things that I could and do teach in state universities. I want to now turn to the test case of the resurrection. I've explained how historians approach these things, their method. Now I want to show you a test case of what they can conclude about the resurrection. Sound like a plan? Sound okay? I should have asked, when do I have to stop talking? When's our next break? Is it 10:30? Okay. Well, I'll just keep talking then. The resurrection. What do secular historians say about the resurrection? I mean, yesterday I talked about what we as Christians say about the resurrection. It is the first fruits of the new creation. It is the down payment of God restoring all things to the world. It is, if you remember my Wynton Marsalis analogy, it is the first notes of the beautiful tune that God will bring to all creation. But that's apologetics. That's theology. What does an historian say about the resurrection of Jesus? Even scholars who don't believe a resurrection is possible think that something very weird happened. And I'm going to explain why they think something very weird must have happened. But let me begin this test case with a most unusual quotation. Concerning the resurrection of Jesus on Easter Sunday, I was for decades a denier. I am no longer a denier, since the following deliberation has caused me to think this through anew. When these peasants, shepherds, and fishermen, who betrayed and denied their master, and then failed him miserably, suddenly could be changed overnight into a confident mission society, convinced of salvation and able to work with much more success after Easter than before Easter, then no vision or hallucination is sufficient to explain such a revolutionary transformation. If the defeated and depressed group of disciples overnight could change into a victorious movement of faith based only on auto-suggestion or self-deception, without a fundamental faith experience, then this would be a much greater miracle than the resurrection itself. In a purely logical analysis, the resurrection of Jesus is the lesser of two evils for all those who seek a rational explanation of the worldwide consequences of that Easter faith. That sounds like it's written by a Christian. Except it's not. It's written by a famous Jewish historian called Pinchas Lapid from Bar-Ilan University in Israel. And he actually, he'd passed away, was an Orthodox Jew who did not believe Jesus was Messiah. And yet, as a historian, he wrote a book about the resurrection of Jesus and concluded this was a real event. You might ask, how could an Orthodox Jew think Jesus rose again and not decide to become a Christian? You'd have to read the book to see his explanation. It is ingenious, ingenious. It is essentially, he thinks God raised Jesus to start the heresy called Christianity, to get the pagan world believing in one God. So God used a false miracle in order to convert the world to monotheism. Anyway, you don't need to know that. The point is, here is a non-Christian historian who thinks the evidence for Jesus' resurrection is strong. Now, this doesn't prove the resurrection took place. Of course it doesn't. But it does highlight a really important thing to know as a Christian. Secular historians take the resurrection pretty seriously. Even those who don't believe a resurrection is possible agree that it is worth studying because there's enough evidence for us to know something very strange happened. There was a summary of historical scholarship on Jesus' resurrection from many years ago now, back in 1996, that counted 94 peer-reviewed scholarly works on the resurrection of Jesus. These are not theological works on Jesus. These are historical works on Jesus' resurrection. I would say that number would be double by now. There'd be 200 such works. Oxford University held a conference around the resurrection of Jesus. It wasn't just theology. It studied it from a perspective of philosophy and science and history as well. There is a major 800-page book by N.T. Wright, which many regard as the most significant book ever written on the resurrection. There is another one written by an atheist called Gerd Ludemann, who is nonetheless an expert in the New Testament and the ancient world. And although he doesn't believe a resurrection is possible, he thought there's enough evidence to write a whole book analyzing it. There's the great Jewish scholar Gaze of Amesh from Oxford University also wrote a book on the resurrection. Though he himself doesn't conclude Jesus rose again, he thinks we know that there's pretty good early evidence that something very weird happened. And more recently, there's a book by Michael Lacona on the resurrection. These are all academic historical books about the resurrection. And the conversation continues. And all of this is simply to underline for you, the resurrection is taken more seriously than you might imagine. I mean, I know you take the resurrection seriously, I trust, if you're a Christian. The resurrection is the foundation. But many of our skeptical friends think it's ridiculous to believe in a resurrection. You might as well believe in Santa Claus. But the thing that's worth knowing is actually the resurrection story is taken seriously as an actual historical study. You won't find any historians studying Santa Claus. There are no historians studying The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, the historical evidence for the Lord of the Rings. No. But they are studying the resurrection. It's a serious academic puzzle. Why is it still a puzzle? Why is it taken at all seriously? Two main reasons. One, the tomb in which Jesus had been laid was probably found empty. Now, if you know your New Testament, you know the tomb was definitely empty, right? And I agree with you. What I'm saying is what a secular historian concludes. It was probably empty. Why do they think this? Three reasons. Let me quote Geza Vemesh, whom I got to interview some years ago, just before he died. He is the professor of Jewish studies for 40 years, one of the main translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls, not a Christian, but he did write on the historical Jesus. From these various records, two reasonably convincing points merge, one positive, the other negative. First, the women belonging to the entourage of Jesus discovered an empty tomb and were definite that it was the tomb. Second, the rumor that the apostles stole the body is most improbable. Why does he come to this conclusion? Why do many people come to this conclusion who aren't Christians? Three reasons. One, the tomb is mentioned in three independent sources. Remember, I'm going back to that stuff I mentioned in terms of methodology. There are three sources that haven't been copied from one another from within a generation of the events. Three separate sources that mention it. Secondly, the tomb narrative was a much harder story to tell. The idea here is that it would have been much easier for them to have said that Jesus was buried in a shallow grave, like many crucifixion victims were, not in a public tomb. If he'd been buried in a nondescript shallow grave, that would have been a much easier story to tell that he rose again, because no one could go and check. But if he was buried in a public tomb, which is what the Gospels say, it was a much harder story to tell. And in fact, we have evidence from the first century that Jewish leaders in the first century claimed that the disciples stole the body of Jesus from the tomb. What does that tell the modern historian? It tells the modern historian there was an empty tomb, doesn't it? Otherwise, why would the leaders opposing Christianity agree there was an empty tomb and make up the story that the disciples stole the body? And the third reason is that the testimony about the discovery of the empty tomb centers on women. This may not sound like very much to us today, but it's very interesting to the historian that all four Gospels say women were the first witnesses of an empty tomb. Why is that significant? Because a woman's testimony was very lowly regarded in the first century. Only under certain conditions could a woman even give a testimony in court. A woman's testimony was not regarded as evidence. And I'm sorry to quote these ancient writings, but here's the proof that that's how they thought of women. Josephus writes, "From women let no evidence be accepted because of the levity and temerity of their sex." There's another ruling from the Mishnah which says, "The law governing an oath of testimony applies to men and not to women, to those who are suitable to bear witness and not to those who are unsuitable to bear witness." Now, I'm embarrassed even reading these out with so many women in the building, and I apologize. But it's important to know that this is how first century people thought about women's testimony. Now you turn to the Gospels. Why did the Gospel writers all say women were the first to know that empty tomb? If they were making up a story, if this were an invention, you would never have women as the primary witnesses, unless that's just how it happened, and so you had to record it. And actually, the fact that women are so prominent in the gospel narrative caused the Christians problems in the first couple of centuries, because many pagans, Greeks and Romans, thought that the fact that women were the first witnesses meant that it probably wasn't true. But for the modern historian, this is a very good reason to think that this is good reporting. Because if women hadn't discovered the empty tomb, you would never have included women in the story. You would remove the women from the story and make men the witnesses. Many scholars, secular scholars, find this a very compelling reason to agree the tomb was empty. Of course, an empty tomb can be interpreted in a number of ways, including the disciples stole the body. So actually, there is a second reason, in addition to the first, why historians take the resurrection seriously, and here it is. From the beginning, people claimed in good faith to be eyewitnesses of the risen Jesus. From the beginning, people claimed in good faith to be eyewitnesses of the risen Jesus. Our evidence for this statement is widespread, direct, early, unexpected, and sincere. Let me explain what I mean by all of those. Firstly, it is widespread. Basically, every single source in the New Testament, remember there were many different sources now in the New Testament, every single one of them refers to people seeing the risen Jesus. And it's probably fair to say that no professional historian today doubts that the earliest disciples really thought they saw Jesus. The evidence is too widespread. We also have direct evidence because Paul himself lists this little creed in yellow, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12. And then look what he says. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also. This is direct evidence. We actually have the writing of someone who said, I have seen Jesus. And he personally knows all these other witnesses mentioned in this source. This source is especially important because it is also very, very early. There are complicated arguments involved, but even highly skeptical and atheist scholars believe that the bit in yellow there, that Christ died for our sins, etc., was a creed coming from the earliest months or maybe a few years of Jesus himself. That is, the little statement about Jesus being raised on the third day according to the scriptures and appearing to Peter and then to the 12, we can date that, not even to the year 50, you know, 20 years after Jesus, but right back to either the year 32, 33, or 34. So within just a few years of the events of Jesus. And this is not just my apologetics. An atheist scholar like Gerd Ludemann would agree with what I've just said. Robert Funk, another atheist, would agree the same. And what that means is this is incredibly early. No one can validly claim the resurrection is a late legend. It's impossible. Because here is a text too close to the events themselves saying that he rose again. Now, it might be a lie, might be an invention, but what I'm saying is it cannot be a late legend. It is a very early claim. It's unexpected. Why do I say the evidence is unexpected? Two of our witnesses were unbelievers when they got their resurrection appearances. I often meet people who say, why did Jesus only appear to believers? Why didn't he appear to unbelievers? That would be more convincing. And my reply is, he did. On two occasions. It's just that those two people then became Christians. They were not Christians beforehand. And I'm talking about Paul, of course, who was an opponent of Christianity and had his life completely turned upside down because he saw the risen Jesus. And I'm also talking about James, the brother of Jesus. In the Gospels, the brothers of the Lord, they're called, did not believe in Jesus. This is very clear in John's Gospel and Mark's Gospel. They did not believe. But here we learn that Jesus appeared to James. And the next we hear of James, he is in the book of Acts and he is the leader of the Jerusalem church. He's everywhere in the book of Acts as the leader of the Jerusalem church. So on two occasions, Jesus did appear to people who disbelieved. And that appearance caused them to believe. And it changed their lives. But why do I say the evidence is sincere? Why do secular historians think the evidence is sincere? Virtually everyone working on the problem of the resurrection comes to the same conclusion. The original witnesses really thought they saw Jesus. Whatever explains that, they really thought they saw the risen Jesus. Why do historians think this? Because these witnesses suffered. They did not gain. If these witnesses suddenly became celebrities, rich and powerful because of the claim of the resurrection, we might be suspicious. But the very people who claimed to have seen Jesus lost property because of it, lost status because of it, lost money because of it, lost their freedom because of it, lost their health because of it. And on numerous instances, they lost their lives. Now, it is true that people die for things they simply believe in. So if I died for my faith, you would at least conclude I really believed in Christianity, but it doesn't demonstrate anything except that I really believed, right? Because who dies for what they know to be a lie? Here's the thing. These original witnesses to the resurrection, at least four of them, we have very good evidence, at least four, died for the claim. And historians look at that and think to themselves, there's no way they were lying. Because no one dies for what they know they just made up. And so, Joseph Klausner, often regarded as the father of the Jewish academic study of Jesus, wrote, "It is impossible to suppose there was any conscious deception around the resurrection." Ed Sanders, whom I've already quoted as a reasonably skeptical scholar, not at all into Christian apologetics, look what he says about this. "I do not regard deliberate fraud as a worthwhile explanation. Many of the people in these lists of witnesses were to spend the rest of their lives proclaiming that they had seen the risen Lord, and several of them would die for their cause. That Jesus' followers and later Paul had resurrection experiences is, in my judgment, a fact. What the reality was that gave rise to the experiences, I do not know." Here is a man who isn't sure what to make of the resurrection, but he is sure people thought they saw the risen Jesus. In some ways, he's just being a good historian. He's not introducing theology and philosophy into his historical conclusion. He just thinks the evidence makes clear there were many people who thought they saw Jesus. Gezivamesh, whom I've mentioned, for more than 30 years, professor of Jewish studies at Oxford University, wrote 8 or 9 books about Jesus, actually. Not a Christian, but he was fascinated by the historical figure of Jesus. And his last book was this one, The Resurrection, in which he outlined what he believed was the best evidence around the resurrection. And he concludes over 200 pages what I have just told you in this lecture. There was an empty tomb, and many people thought they saw Jesus alive again. They are the two facts of history. Empty tomb, many people thought they saw him. So what does Gezivamesh think happened? He doesn't tell us. In fact, it's quite frustrating because he has an epilogue at the end of the book listing 6 possible natural explanations of the evidence. He goes through the explanation that the disciples stole the body. He goes through the explanation that Jesus just got better in the tomb and rolled the stone away himself. He goes through 6 attempts to explain away the evidence. And he concludes that none of them can be believed historically. So then you turn the page and you think, well, what do you think? And there's nothing. Historians might not believe that Jesus rose glorious in a body to the right hand of the Father, but they believe something very strange happened the first Easter. And there was an empty tomb, and people thought they saw him. Which I like to point out means we have the kind of historical evidence a resurrection would leave behind, and more evidence pointing in that direction than we could expect if it were a fraud, mistake, or legend. But how we interpret that evidence depends not on these historical considerations, but on our background beliefs about God and nature. So, if the resurrection took place, it could only leave behind the 2 pieces of evidence it has actually left behind. Evidence there was an empty tomb, evidence that lots of people thought they saw him. What other evidence could it leave behind? You know, X-ray flash on a wall or something? I mean, we have exactly the kind of evidence a resurrection would leave behind. But how we interpret that evidence, of course, relies on whether you believe in God. Because if people don't believe in God, it doesn't matter how good the evidence was, they wouldn't believe in a resurrection. Their non-believing belief in God makes them stuck, unable to believe in a resurrection, even if there's good, strong evidence. But if someone does believe in God, does believe that the God behind the laws of nature could raise someone from the dead, the interesting thing is, in one case in history, we have exactly the kind of evidence a resurrection would leave behind. This is why Jesus and the resurrection are still taken seriously by non-Christian historians. And these are some of the arguments you can lay out to your friends who ask you about these things. But I don't believe that arguments like these will convert people. In my view, the purpose of historical argumentation, apart from it being a nice discipline, I love ancient history, but the purpose for us as Christians for historical argumentation is to take away people's silly reasons not to even look into Christianity. The value of historical argumentation is not to convert people, but to show that their reasons for not even investigating Christianity are not strong. And I hope in historical argumentation to convince our skeptical friends to pick up a gospel for themselves and realize they're not going to read The Lord of the Rings or an epic about Thor. They're going to read a historical document. And my view of how apologetics works is simply this. Apologetics provides reasons for people to be a little more open to investigating Jesus in the Gospels. And when they do that, God, by His Spirit, introduces them to Jesus the Lord. Historical argument won't convert. But historical argument will convince people to pick up a gospel. And that's where they'll meet Jesus. I have said more than enough this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. There is a shroud in Turin. Is that a possible non-biblical evidence also?
I know there are some apologists, Christian apologists, who make the case, and their case, I understand that it can sound compelling. But secular ancient historians don't give it any weight at all. They don't find it at all compelling because they don't even think it can be shown to be a first century cloth. So I tend not to talk about the Shroud of Turin. I have met people who believe that it's a real piece of evidence, and I know that there are Christian apologists who can make a compelling case. But in my work, I tend to only want to use arguments that are already accepted by the majority of historians. So all the things I taught you today are accepted by secular historians. But the Shroud of Turin isn't one of them. So that's my feeling about that. Thank you.
Thank you for a very nice talk. I have a couple of questions, actually. One of them is about the sources that you showed on one of the slides. So you said, for instance, that Luke used Mark's gospel and Q and L. So can you open up a bit? What is the rationale for thinking that Q and L were in agreement with Mark's gospel? How do we know these sources said the same thing and it's not just Luke sort of condensing it into his version?
A couple of reasons. Let me get the slide for you. There. So Luke is using Mark, Q, and L. And we can test how faithful Luke is to Mark. Matthew and Luke both use Mark. This is the general conclusion of scholars. 60% of Mark appears in Luke, 80% of Mark appears in Matthew. So that means what we can do is we can compare Luke and Matthew's use of Mark. And when you compare how they use Mark, we know beyond doubting that they are faithful to their source. They're not innovating. They're not changing. They're very conservative. Now, the interesting thing about that is Luke would never had any expectation that we would check how well he used Mark. He could have changed Mark however he liked for his own agenda. But all these years later, we can actually look at Mark and look at Luke's use of Mark, and it's very clear he is a reliable user of prior sources. Now, there is material that isn't in Mark, that it's in Luke and Matthew. And although some scholars think, well, maybe Matthew used Luke or Luke used Matthew, and that's why there's this extra material that's not in Mark but is in both Matthew and Luke, but most scholars think it is a much easier explanation to say that that material that is in Luke and Matthew that's not in Mark comes from another source. And Luke has already told us many have undertaken to draw up an account of these things. So from the opening line, we should expect to find sources in Luke. So we conclude that that material that Luke and Matthew have together, that's not from Mark, we call it Q, just from the German word Quelle, meaning source, right? So it's not very imaginative. But then there's material that is unique to Luke, that isn't in any other gospel, like the parable of the prodigal son or Jesus going to Zacchaeus the tax collector's house. That's only in Luke. So could that have been invented by Luke? Possible. But there's all this material that's unique to Luke that is quite similar to one another in theme and language and quite distinct from Luke's own writing style. We can tell where Luke is writing, and he writes in a certain grammatical style. But this other material, which we call L, in distinction from Mark and Q, all is a little bit different from Luke's own writing style, and it's quite similar to one another. The Zacchaeus story, the parable of the lost sheep, etc. So we conclude that there is another source. Luke has told us he knows of many and that he's investigated them, so we should be on the lookout for sources in Luke. Now, we can be confident that Luke is reliably presenting L because we can already check him on his use of Mark. He used Mark faithfully, even though he would never have expected us to test him. So we can assume that he is using that other material faithfully that we call L. And all of it together is what we call Luke's gospel. I should have pointed out, by the way, that many ancient writings incorporated sources just like this. What we see in the gospels is exactly what we find in other historical artworks.
Thank you. The other one that I have is you showed this passage from Josephus and said that this is what most historians agree is what he actually wrote.
Yep.
Usually when you see this passage, it's a longer version which is a bit embellished, so to say. Yep. It talks about miracles and so on. What makes us think that this is what he actually wrote? So the thinking is that the Christians tampered the original, and we've tried to trace back to the original one. But what makes us think this is actually what he wrote?
Thank you. So what I put up on the screen is what mainstream secular historians think is what Josephus really wrote. But there are other lines in there that I've excluded because they probably were added by a Christian scribe later on. So, for example, it says, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man. And then in the texts it says, if indeed one can call him a man, clearly implying he was more than a man. And then after it says, in the middle there, those who in the first place came to love him did not give up their affection for him. It then says, for he appeared to them alive again after three days and fulfilled all that the prophet said about him. Okay, clearly a non-Christian writer like Josephus wouldn't have written that. So those lines look like a Christian trying to improve what Josephus said. Now, why wouldn't we just say the whole paragraph was invented by Christians? And the answer is, there are too many things here that a Christian probably wouldn't write. So even calling him just a wise man, and then it almost being contradicted by the scribe, if indeed one can call him a man, tells you that there are two hands going on here, two opinions of Jesus. The expression, he wrought surprising feats, this is the Greek words paradoxa erga, baffling deeds, paradoxical deeds. It is a neutral expression to describe Jesus' reputation as a healer. Christians wouldn't describe Jesus' deeds as paradoxa erga. They called them signs, miracles, powers. Josephus writes, the men of highest standing amongst us condemned him. Would a Christian, reflecting on the Jewish people that killed Jesus, call them men of highest standing? And the last expression, the tribe of the Christians called after him, has still to this day not disappeared, sounds like someone who thinks Christianity is likely to disappear. It just hasn't yet. So would a Christian have written that? Probably not. The other one that most think Christians would never have written is where it says, he won over many Jews and many Greeks. But every Christian scribe knew that Jesus did not win over Greeks. This is clearly just Josephus's perspective writing in Rome toward the end of the first century. He knew that many Greeks had become Christians, so he just confuses it and says Jesus led many Jews and Greeks. But everyone who knows their Gospels knows that he only preached to Jews and avoided Greeks. Yes, we've got one or two examples, but he studiously said, do not go to the towns of the Greeks, go only to the lost people of Israel. And only at the end of the Gospel does he send people to the Greeks. Anyway, we spend a lot of time discussing this passage at university, but here are the reasons why most scholars think there was an original paragraph of Josephus, which was then tampered with by Christians to improve it, but the tampering is very easily spotted and removed. And what's left is perfectly plausible as coming from Josephus. And I've used all that time just with those questions, but they're good questions. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Jag vill påminna er, om det är någon som inte har betalat ännu att göra det, det får man göra här i foajén, så finns det också utvärderingsblankett som ni gärna får fylla i och lämna in.